Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, some perspective around the politics, and some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, South Africa wants to send other African countries the bill for migrant repatriations during the recent xenophobic violence. Why nearly half of this country's treated water never makes it to the taps. Is Etiquini bucking the South African unemployment crisis trend? And a big bank turns money lessons into binge-worthy microdramas. It's Monday, the 17th of August. I want to start the program with this story. In South Africa, I read, wants other African governments to help pick up the bill for sending their citizens home. Now, government contends it's spent millions of rand accommodating and transporting migrants, with reimbursement requests reportedly sent to countries including Malawi, Ethiopia and Nigeria. Something in the region of 82,000 people have been deported or voluntarily repatriated during the recent migration tensions. I want to explore, as I say, this issue in a little more detail. Professor Lauren Landau is with me, Director of the African Center for Migration and Society. Professor, welcome to you. So South Africa is effectively saying your citizens, your bill. Is that a fair position to adopt?
I think it suggests that we do need cooperation in the region, but I think in this instance, it's an absurd position to adopt. These people are leaving not because they wished to, but because of the insecurity and the targeting of them as foreign nationals. Even if they were here illegally, then there's a legal process to get them out, and that is something South Africa would have to pay for as part of its law enforcement. So this idea that people are going home out of fear, and then we're kicking another country while it's down. Not only have we sent your citizens back home, we are now asking you to pay for it. And we've seen the reaction from Nigeria. We've seen the reaction from other countries. They similarly see this as an absurd kind of position. And it's an odd one to take just in advance of the SADC summit when we're supposed to be looking at regional cooperation.
Interesting, Prof, that government calls these costs unforeseen, and I put that word in inverted commas. After years of migration pressure, it would seem odd that that is true.
Well, it's unforeseen in the sense that no one expected that you would need, so many people would want to go home, and so many people would need assistance in going home. We saw the thousands of Malawians in front of centers in Durban and Messina. There was a massive kind of glut of people trying to get out. That is unforeseen, because what they haven't foreseen was the kind of mobilization, and they did nothing to stop that, which led to this kind of displacement. So this is not part of a normal migration process. The protests were the unforeseen event that triggered this.
You rightly say that this is happening as the SADC summit begins in KwaZulu-Natal this week. And I guess the obvious question is, could sending these bills damage South Africa's relationships with key African partners? Or do you think that damage has already been done?
There has been damage done. Clearly, the protests, the deportations, the repatriations, the violence has fragmented the region to some extent. And we saw President Ramaphosa say in advance of the summit that he feels shame for that. But the government continues to act in a way that suggests they want South Africa to be in control of regional migration. And I think we're seeing from a number of the neighboring countries that they say migration is part of the regional economy. It's part of how we build prosperity in the region. And they're not willing to accept South Africa's position. So there will be tensions going forward.
And as has been intimated, some of those governments are simply refusing to pay. What can South Africa actually do if that's the case?
I don't know what the options are. Presumably there are bilateral mechanisms through which you could extract certain type of taxes or tariffs. But I think this was done not so much to get the money back, although South Africa needs as much tax revenue as it can get, but rather to send a message that South Africa is serious, that they want the neighboring countries to do something about controlling migration to South Africa. What exactly those countries can do is unclear, but I think that was what they were trying to do with these fares or these fees.
Are you worried that we're obsessing over deportation costs instead of asking why so many people became undocumented in the first place?
I'm not so much worried about the costs. I think that's part of a broader concern with border security and border control and preventing or managing migration in this very restrictive way, rather than focusing on the broader issues with what are the real costs to South Africa of migration and what are the opportunities there. And we should be having that more development-oriented rather than a security conversation. Security issues are real. Intelligence needs to be on top of smuggling networks, etc. But it does feel that we are focusing on the wrong things, but that is because those things are very good sort of symbolism in an election.
So why do you think we're afraid to have the bigger debate then, the more important debate that you're suggesting?
Well, I think this is something that is off the agenda in part because politicians have realized how much they can weaponize the migration discussion to distract us from financial mismanagement, from the rising unemployment rate, from the very real issues that South Africans face on a day-to-day basis. To talk about it in a reasonable way would be to say, okay, we now need to fix the problems that we've helped cause.
It's a question I'm sure, Prof, that you asked all the time, but migrants, and with increasing alacrity, I think, are blamed for jobs, crime, pressure on services. What does the evidence actually say?
Yes, this is a sort of narrative that is circulating globally. So South Africa is well on trend in that regard. But what we see from all of the reliable sources, not necessarily someone's uncle who's seen something, you know, on the street, is that migrants are a net beneficiary for the South African economy. And of course, there's spaces where there's competition. Of course, there's spaces where it does push South Africans out of the job market. But in aggregate, it's a beneficial thing. In terms of services elsewhere, it's a very small part of the demand. But South Africa immigrants are also paying taxes just like everybody else who's working or living here. So what we need to do is say, look, Gauteng is 50% people from somewhere else, but only 7% from another country. The challenges we face in Gauteng and Joburg and elsewhere are because South Africans have moved and we haven't planned for it. It has almost nothing to do with immigrants.
And just a final one, how do you think the business community should be relating to this debate? And do you think it's engaging sufficiently?
I don't think it's engaging sufficiently. What we've seen already is that the drop in tourism, which is primarily Africans coming in who do shopping, who do business here to go back home, has dropped precipitously. That should worry business people and it should worry all South Africans. We shouldn't, of course, see them saying, look, we need this cheap labor from the neighboring countries. They do have to adhere to the law, but we need a business involved so that we can have that kind of economic discussion and to really look at what are the mechanisms that can promote South African prosperity and how can migration be a part of that.
Professor Lauren Landau, thank you very much indeed. You are the director of the African Center for Migration and Society.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa may be heading into a water crisis, not because we simply don't have enough water.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa may be heading into a water crisis, not because we simply don't have enough water, but because we are losing almost half of what we already treat and pump. Around 47%, as I understand it, of treated water never generates revenue. It's lost through, and this is an old story, aging pipes, illegal connections, broken meters, and weak billing systems. That's a real issue here in Johannesburg. I want to talk now to Junaid Kader, who's head of public-private partnerships and infrastructure at the workplace management solutions company Tsebo. He's been with us on the program before. Junaid, welcome to you. And again, the question that so many of us ask, how does a country lose almost half of its treated water before it even reaches you and I through the tap?
Our immediate crisis, as you say, isn't simply the water we don't have. It's also the water we already treat, pump and pay for, and then lose before it reaches the consumer. So roughly 47% of it never generates a cent, and it leaks from our aging pipes, and almost half of everything we produce is gone. before it does any useful work. Now, the point is that we are losing this significant amount of water through, you know, contributing factors that is being experienced nationally. And the responsibility basically is with national government. And let me break it down for you in terms of the levels of responsibility and where the actual breakdown is.
Right.
Bulk supply is generally not the biggest problem. Department of Water and Sanitation and Water Boards, they have relatively sophisticated infrastructure and operating systems for producing and moving bulk water. The main cause and where the system fails is municipal reticulation. It is the biggest physical failure point. And this can be categorized into three areas of failures. The first one is physical losses. This is where physical real losses become particularly important. When national non-revenue water, which is a measure of the 47% we talk about, and that's according to the No Drop report for 2025. So once the water enters the municipal distribution system, we have aging, deteriorating pipes, leaking mains, burst pipes, excessive network pressure, and limited asset management information. So that basically is the majority of the water loss, where we have physical losses, and the lesser evil would be the commercial losses.
Right.
Where we have metering, billing, and revenue collection.
So you list a litany of problems here. If almost 50% of water is effectively disappearing, I guess we've got to ask the question then about why we are still talking and talking up new dams and new supply before fixing the system that we already have.
Yeah, so, you know, you can't build your way out of a leak. And that's way I put it. South Africa needs new infrastructure, but new infrastructure cannot compensate for a failing distribution network. The instinct automatically is an infrastructure crisis is understandably to build new dams or new bulk schemes. But South Africa does need new infrastructure. But new infrastructure cannot substitute for the systematic rehabilitation and renewal of infrastructure we already own. But the fastest, cheapest gains over the next 3 years lie in managing what we already have and getting value from infrastructure already in the ground. For example, doing pressure management, active leak detection, district metered areas, and improving our metering and billing. So the principle basically is simple. Before investing billions in finding another liter of water, we should ask how much of that water we already have can be recovered.
You also mentioned that countries like Namibia and, if I'm correct, Israel and Singapore use or reuse treated wastewater successfully. Why have we been so slow to do the same at scale?
I use it as a lesson, as an example that we can use. And the important lesson isn't what we should copy another country's model. It is what wastewater can be treated to a standard that allows it to become a valuable additional water resource. So those countries demonstrate that water reuse can form part of a broader national water security strategy. So for South Africa, the immediate lesson is to start with practical applications where the case is strongest. For example, in our industrial, mining, and agricultural sectors, where we reuse the water and build confidence through rigorous standards and monitoring of that water. So over time, we could reach a point where we are appropriately regulated to use potable water, and it can then materialize where we reuse it for drinking water.
And Junaid, just a final question. You argue strongly for more public-private partnership. I understand that. But what happens when municipalities themselves have weak billing systems and poor financial controls? Can private capital realistically fix a fundamentally broken institution?
You speak about the failures within the systems, and government has the ultimate responsibility for ensuring reliable and equitable services. So we shouldn't avoid that accountability. But acknowledging government's responsibility doesn't mean government has to perform every function itself. The more constructive question is, what capabilities does government need to fulfill its responsibility effectively? Where government has the capacity, it should use it. Where additional technical, financial, or operational capability is required, for PPPs, the partnerships can provide the capacity while government retains accountability, regulation, and ownership. So government has resources, but the question is whether it has sufficient financial and technical capacity at every level to deliver the scale of intervention that is required. So that is why I don't see the private sector as replacing government. I see it as complementing government where there is a capacity gap.
Junaid Kader, I am going to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for the insight. Head of Public-Private Partnerships and Infrastructure at Workplace Management Solutions Company, Tsebo. Think you found the perfect investment? Let's check. Join MoneyWeb editor Rake van Niekerk at the Money Summit, where he'll reveal the warning signs of today's biggest investment scams, from fake trading platforms to promises of guaranteed returns. Learn how to protect your money before it's too late. Tuesday, the 1st of September at the Sandton Convention Center. Register for free using the promo code MoneyWeb. Visit moneyweb.co.za and secure your seat today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, at a time when South Africa's unemployment rate has climbed back to over 33%, almost 34%, one major city, it seems, might be moving sharply in the opposite direction. eThekwini now has the lowest official unemployment rate of any of the country's metros at 21.2%, marginally better than Cape Town, and it's the only metro where unemployment fell both quarterly and year on year. So does that really make Durban South Africa's new jobs powerhouse? What's actually driving the numbers? Or is there a counterpoint to this argument? I want to talk to Professor Justin Fasahi, who's Associate Professor at the Southern Center for Inequality Studies at Wits University here in Johannesburg. Justin, welcome to you. So is eThekwini genuinely creating more jobs, or does the unemployment rate just make the picture look a little better than it really is?
Thanks for having me on the call, Jeremy. It's unfortunately quite a technical discussion, but I think important for the readers and, sorry, your listeners to appreciate. And that's that these results ultimately come down to StatsSA sampling a group of households in South Africa. And they collect information on around 60,000 individuals in total. And it's actually a miracle of statistics that you can use just 60,000 people to, you know, represent 63 million and get quite an accurate result. But what people need to be aware of is that there can be a lot of politics that goes on in how you recreate the numbers, how you do the sampling. And unfortunately, when it comes to this very localized picture of unemployment and employment in eThekwini, it's just not being measured accurately enough. So to start off with, it's just not true to say that eThekwini is now the new sort of employment capital of the country. We need more data. We need bigger samples. That said, our cities definitely need to employ more people, and it's an important issue. But I think we need more time, and we need more research to really make this a real number and not just something that's part of statistical modeling.
So to that point then, what specific evidence would convince you this is a genuine jobs boom rather than just, as you're suggesting, some kind of anomalous statistical movement?
Yeah, good question. And I think a few things. The one is that when you repeat these surveys over time, you get more confidence if the numbers remain consistent over a period of time. And what we see with the quarterly labor force statistics is that Cape Town does perform consistently better than the other metros. I think eThekwini performs okay, but I would be surprised if it was the number one performer. We would need more of these surveys to take place and then compare averaging over a sort of at least a year or 2 year period. The second is that we can use other sources of data. I'm involved with a project where we actually mine tax returns. And this is a very accurate because in some ways it's a whole universe of the formal employment. And when you look at and you measure employment in terms of tax data, in terms of our cities, what we see is Cape Town has performed number one since 2014. To date, that's when the data period starts. Tshwane is number two, and eThekwini is number three. So it's true, eThekwini has been performing a bit better, but as I've said, I wouldn't over bloat the story to say eThekwini is now number one.
Let's give KZN, though, the benefit of the doubt, and maybe just because I spent a couple of very happy years working there. But your broader research also shows that Durban still has a substantial base in trade services, public and social services, I think you list. I think you might add to that list manufacturing and logistics. Are you able to tell us then which of those sectors is actually producing real meaningful jobs?
Yes, again, an important question. And we can certainly use the tax data, which is very granular, to sort of get a better picture of what's driving growth in our different cities. And again, I think it's important to emphasize that they don't have to compete with one another. There's a lot of politics around the numbers and who's better and who's worse. But I think everyone in South Africa really has an incentive for all our cities to do better. And so eThekwini can do well, and that can actually drive growth in other parts of the country. eThekwini's strength has definitely been its manufacturing base, and in fact, fairly diversified, not just one particular manufacturing industry, like you see, for instance, in Nelson Mandela Bay, where it's sort of very automotive heavy. Ekurhuleni has tended to be more around heavy industry. eThekwini has more of a diversified sector, so that's a strength. But the truth is that all manufacturing industries have actually been in trouble in South Africa over the last decade. And so the automotive industry has done a little bit better. In eThekwini, you also see food and beverages also performing better. But then other sectors declining, clothing and textiles, for instance. So eThekwini does have a manufacturing future, but it's certainly under a process of pressure and change and evolution. And it does need to diversify into places where it can sort of compete and export on a global level. That's ultimately what we're looking for.
Surely the fact that it has the country's busiest port must, in one way or another, count in its favor, maybe just because of the ancillary industries that occupy space around that.
Definitely. And again, this is a story of some of South Africa's biggest economic woes over the last 10 to even 20 years has been that we haven't looked after our state-owned enterprises. Eskom is the prime example. So, and I think that Transnet doesn't fall too far away from that. I remain optimistic that we have been under a process of reform since we've had coalition government. And I think there's been a heightened appreciation that you need the right skills leading these key state entities. Because if you don't get that sort of public infrastructure working, clearly so many businesses depend on it. So eThekwini's port, I mean, it's the busiest port in Africa, a key entryway into Gauteng. Again, it's not going anywhere, but I think that if anything, we haven't invested enough in our new infrastructure, and it can become a drain rather than a sort of springboard for the future. So very important that infrastructure gets turned around, and that we focus on Transnet and the performance of Transnet to be more competitive.
And Justin, just a quick one in conclusion. Is there anything that the other metros can specifically learn from what Cape Town is doing?
Each metro faces a unique situation. So in some ways, it's a bit unfair to compare them. For instance, Cape Town, in terms of its demographic base, has always had a more educated population. So in some ways, they're lucky. Whereas eThekwini, for instance, I think actually has a large rural and populations that are part of its base. So all the metros have different baselines, and sometimes this means they have unique circumstances. But there are key lessons, and I think that what Cape Town has done very well is in doing the basics right. They've invested a lot of infrastructure in terms of performance and monitoring, and a system of sort of integrated governance across all of their line departments that line up. Whereas some of the other metros, Johannesburg is a prime example, has tended to have silos, multiple entities, multiple leadership bodies. Often at cross purposes with one another, and not enough of clear line of sight of deliverables on the ground. So for eThekwini, and the listeners might be aware of the presidential working group for eThekwini that's been working for the last 2 years. These are important initiatives where we don't just think about different departments in isolation of one another, but you've got to sort of stitch it up together, that the investment in road, rail, water, utilities, and other industrial incentives all come together, working in the same direction. And I think Cape Town is a prime example of doing that very well in terms of their integrated governance model.
Justin Versace, Associate Professor at the Southern Center for Inequality Studies at the University of the Witwatersrand. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, here's an interesting question. Can TikTok teach you how to manage your money better? Well, Absa is betting that it can. The bank is launching For Better or For Whatever. It's billed as South Africa's first bank-led micro drama. using short comedy episodes about weddings, families, relationships, scams, and money to deliver financial lessons through entertainment rather than traditional financial education. So here's my question. Is this a clever new way to improve financial literacy, or simply a very sophisticated way of a bank marketing itself? I'm in conversation now with Sadiq Fakir, who is Executive Digital Marketing and Media at ABSA. Sadiq, welcome to you. So strip away the comedy and the wedding drama. Is this genuinely financial education, or is it just a clever way of advertising for the bank?
Thank you for the opportunity. This is definitely a new way to engage with our customers, but 100%, it is all about putting our customers and the country forward and first in educating them on financial wellness. Now, if you have to look at it, being a brand, we have to absolutely understand we are seeing a complete shift in the way customers engage with brands. We know traditional advertising works, but in some way it feels like a one-way conversation and really pushing to buy or really not understanding where to meet our customer. So whilst we believe that there are different mechanisms to attract and engage our customer, we believe in two-way conversation that is entertaining and educational.
And I think one of the key words that you've just used in that description is entertaining. How do you design the storyline then to make sure that it is, one, compelling, and Sadiq also carries a degree of authenticity around it?
So we've realized that traditional ways of teaching financial wellness, financial literacy, it doesn't resonate with everybody, Jeremy. So you have these big complex terms, it's overwhelming. And we see that most of us are consistently on our phones. In fact, the average South African has probably two devices, Jeremy, a work device and a personal device. And we understand that the customer is engaging vertical content. So that's why we decided to launch this micro drama series. It's fun, it's engaging, and it's a great way to tell stories. Knowing that ABSA does stand for Your Story Matters, we believe storytelling and entertainment is a great way. Now, what we've done is we've weaved financial lessons and stories into these micro episodes. So short, sharp pieces of content, easily shareable, and definitely we've seen the trend of micro dramas. They're absolutely binge-worthy as well.
So how do you design the storylines then?
So we've taken characters, and there's absolute drama. It's a wedding set, and it's two formidable families coming together, and you can absolutely expect, Jeremy, there's going to be drama. Anything in an African wedding scene, you already know there's going to be drama, there's going to be mayhem, there's going to be comedic scenes. And we've looked at the series really mirroring everyday realities that many South Africans experience. So for instance, the series has two families brought together, and they're going to be faced with situations like budgeting for the big event, supporting family members, or dealing with unexpected expenses. And these situations, many of us can identify with. And I assure you that as our viewers consume this beautiful content, they will resonate with characters. And in fact, you'll find similarities, whether it be in your family, your friendship circle, or your network. I personally have already resonated with some of the characters, and I see myself.
Sadiqa, what evidence do you have that actually watching a 60-second drama will change the way someone thinks about money or designs their approach towards money?
I think the headlines are everywhere, Jeremy, that micro dramas are growing and taking off with a boom globally. In fact, a latest study from Deloitte has shown that the industry itself is $14 billion for this year. So there's mass investment in the space of content. The second thing we've also seen, a stat in, that micro and vertical dramas have actually taken 44% more viewing time than horizontal long format content. So our stats are there. And in turn, we've also seen that majority of South Africans, 75% or more, are mobile connected. In addition, we've also seen a growth of TikTok with more than 23 million South Africans consuming the platform. We have just, of course, come in as ABSA, as South Africa's first bank, to come in with a micro drama series because we stacked up these insights and we looked at consumption patterns.
And I can hear that you're very excited about it, but let me come back at you and say that there is potentially the danger that putting serious financial issues into a comedy format maybe trivializes the real financial pressure that many of us are facing right now.
And I go back to customer insight. consumers are already scared. There is too much of information. We've definitely taken the insight of simplifying the information, and this is a conduit or an entry point to a financial wellness hub that we've actually created to actually unpack the financial literacy, protecting your money and making your money go further in a hub that explains everything in a simple manner. So we also understand South Africans are time strapped, and we don't see this as trivializing, but in fact, making it resonate with the way the customer wants to engage with us.
You talk, or there's also the evidence, and correct me if I'm wrong, that maybe TikTok and other social platforms are often places where financial misinformation and scams, Sadiqa, spread very quickly. There's an irony, isn't there, that using those platforms can actually teach people to be more cautious online. Have you recognized that that conundrum?
We've absolutely recognized this, and this is why we always ensure that our content is compliance friendly. We also adhere to our regulators and their requirements. The greatest thing that we've noticed is that banks are trusted, and we want to continue that narrative that we take our customers' money exceptionally seriously and the protection of their money exceptionally seriously. There is always a conundrum, and we have the mechanisms and the mechanics behind us. For example, all social media platforms from a corporate perspective are always verified, so the content coming out from us would not be deemed fake news. We also have systems that trigger any form of scam alert, and we have our social listening and social media also very, very high risk and high alert.
Sadiqa Fakir, thank you very much indeed. You're Executive Digital Marketing and Media at the APSA Group. I do appreciate your time. Thank you. And on that note, we will finish today's program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.